sure we'll have a couple of people trickling in still. So hello, everyone. I'm Ben Armstrong, Program Manager on the Hyper-V and Core Virtualization team. And I'm here today to talk about Windows Server Containers. We have this nice little intro slide that we've been doing for this talk, because one of the things that we do want to be very clear about is that the goal of this talk and these series of talks is to just kind of introduce you to this technology. I'm afraid you're not going to leave this session an expert on everything in containers. But we're hoping we can give you some information and help you to start thinking about how you could potentially use this. So before I get going, I always like to ask questions of my audience. So how many people here have heard about this thing called containers? Yay, that's good. You read the press and talk to people. How many people have heard about Docker? Once again, good, you read the press. How many people have actually used Docker? That number of hands is kind of increasing. I'm happy. I'd say there was about 30% of the room. Let me tell you, at the beginning of this year in February, I did an event where I asked the room how many people had used Docker, and two people raised their hands. So that was kind of awkward. How many people have actually played with Windows containers? Okay, a couple of hands, that's good to see. So we have made a public preview available of with Windows containers. And I'm going to be talking about kind of the motivation behind it and how this all comes together, and I'm going to be showing you how this works. The final disclaimer I want to give before I get started on this is that container technology is a very new thing. It's something that we're working on right now. It's kind of in alpha. It's a V1. I'm really excited about it, but that also has the interesting problem that it means that genuinely we kind of don't know what we're doing. And this is, you know, I chat to people about this, you know, because how many people here have heard the saying that, like, you know, Microsoft products only get good around the V3? Everyone knows this. Let me tell you, this is actually fact. You know, this is the way the world works, because what happens is on the engineering team, we come up with an idea and we say, okay, we want to go and build something, but it's really hard to go out and validate ideas with users when they've never used the technology. You know, and so we end up spending a lot of times where we're kind of making decisions and we're going, you know, we either end up going like, well, you know, let's just, you know, flip a coin and choose the one that looks easiest. Or there are even times when we go, like, we don't know what the right way to do it is, so we're going to enable both ways and we're going to see what users do. And we get the V1 out and we immediately start working on the V2, but the problem is we haven't got feedback from users yet. So the V2 ends up just being the things we wanted to do on the V1 and didn't get around to. And it isn't until we're working on the V3 that we actually have real feedback from users. And then we can actually take it into consideration. Now, I like to highlight to people, a lot of people like either weren't around or they missed this entirely, but I've been working on virtual machines for 15 years, and let me tell you, when we started working on virtual machines for server, we built the wrong thing for the wrong market, because we didn't know what we were doing. Like, when we were first building the first version of virtual server, we had it in our heads that, like, this is gonna be awesome for app compat problems for servers. And we had this whole focus where we're like, it's gonna be great for letting you run your NT4 applications on Windows Server 2003. And it wasn't until we got it out to beta and we got it out to customers and all of our customers started using it to run whole instances of Windows Server 2003 inside of virtual machines, and we were really confused, and our customers actually introduced us to the idea that you could use server virtualization for consolidation. You know, and we had to turn around and change, you know, all our plans and all our messaging. You know, so why am I giving all this background? I'm giving all this background for two reasons. The first one is to just set up, we're going to get to the end of this session, and you guys are going to have a bunch of questions, and to half the questions, I'm going to sit there and go like, that is a good question. One day we should have an answer for that question. So be ready for that moment. The other thing, though, is the biggest thing, the biggest request, the biggest ask I have of you is please play with the technology and talk to us. you know, think about how it could work and give us feedback, because that's the mode we're in right now. We're having a lot of fun building this, but we're also trying to figure out what we should be building and how we should be changing it. So with all that background, why are we building containers? And what is this all about? Well, there's a bit of an important, you know, background and engineering mentality to understand. So as I said, you know, we started building virtual machines about 15 years ago. And genuinely, none of us had any idea that there would one day be a thing called the cloud. I mean, we really started out, I can remember being like, woo, we can run two operating systems at once on a single computer. Yay! Like, that was the motivation. You know, that's where we started out. We were just like very tactical. And so a lot of the focus for virtual machines was actually about how to make it really easy to take the practices and the tools and the approaches that you use for physical computers and apply them to virtual machines. And one of the things I like to point out, and this is a bit of a trip in the time machine, but I can actually remember being on the engineering team when we did significant work in the very first version of Virtual Server to allow people to use Norton Ghost to restore images into virtual machines. You know, but that was the sort of mentality we had, was we were looking at, you know, okay, take all the tooling and stuff for physical computers and just make it work in a virtualized environment. So, you know, we started working on this, the technology started coming along, and we started to see people offering hosted services. You know, I talk to people who have been in the industry for a long time, and they say, like, we used to be an ASP. Like, that's a phrase people don't use anymore. But the ASPs were the first ones to go, like, hey, we can run these virtual machines, and we can use them to offer services to people. And from that grew the concept of cloud computing. And it's been a long evolution, and it is fascinating watching new companies forming today. Because new companies that form today operate in a mode where they assume that there's going to be a server out there somewhere that does all the stuff, and it's easy to get, and I don't have to worry about those details. And we're starting to see applications and companies being built not just no cloud first, but cloud only. And so what we're doing with containers is we're kind of going back to the drawing board and we're saying, okay, what if we, you know, put aside everything that we know and think about virtual machines and instead build a virtualization solution that is designed to be great for cloud environments. And that's what we've been really pushing ourselves on, is we've been pushing ourselves and going through and looking at, you know, and a lot of the design decisions were, you know, just unintentional, you know, but looking at the design decisions and going, like, right, like, what does it mean to build this for a world that's all about cloud computing as opposed to a world that's all about physical computers? So what that means for you is there are a lot of things that are going to be different. There are a lot, I spend a lot of time with people coming to me and saying, like, well, how do I take this thing that I do in virtual machines and do it in containers? And half the time the answer is, well, you don't. You do it a completely different way. And I'll highlight that as we're going through. But that's kind of the background and the thinking here. So now we're going to spend a bunch of time talking about the different kind of aspects of containers. We're going to talk about runtimes, we're going to talk about the image, we're going to talk about image repository, and we're going to talk about the overall ecosystem. So let's start with the runtime. So one thing we'd like to highlight is the difference between containers and virtual machines. So you always start with a physical computer, and it has an operating system where your applications run. Now, in the case of virtual machines, what we do is we create a virtualization layer that looks and feels just like a physical computer. And on top of that, you install your operating system and you install your applications. Great. Hopefully, we're all familiar with this. Now, with containers, things are a bit different. With containers, what we do is we create a virtualization layer that looks and feels just like an operating system, rather than one that looks and feels like a physical computer. And then you're able to install your applications on top of those. Now, an interesting thing is, and this is actually a great debate, is do you run containers on bare metal or do you run them in virtual machines? Because a bit of background here, the first thing to highlight is actually most people are running them inside of virtual machines today. And this is one of those first ones where we on the engineering team are like, that's a really good question. Like, we're actually curious to see, you know, where are people going to run these on bare metal or are they going to run them in virtual machines? But a bit of a background here. So we've had, you know, various prototypes and bits and pieces of container technology floating around on the core team for a while now. And whenever we've gone out and talked to customers about the concepts of containers, people haven't been really that interested. And it was about 24 months ago that, thanks to the work done by Docker, Linux containers started taking off. And when it started taking off, we were looking closely at this and being like, why are people interested in this when they haven't been interested in things that we've talked about in the past? And what we realized was there was a really interesting inflection point in the industry. Because thankfully, they've removed this material from their website. But when Docker was just starting to take off, they actually had a period of time where on their website, they were like, hey, Docker, it's great. You can use it to an infamous phrase, write once, run anywhere. And I remember reading that and being really angry. Because I'm like, it's not write once, run anywhere. It's write once, run anywhere that there's a Linux 3.8 kernel. Like, come on. I spent a couple of days being like, until I had the moment when I went, wait a second. Virtualization is so prevalent. Virtualization is now so successful that you can run a Linux 3.8 kernel anywhere. And so when they say write once, run anywhere, they actually kind of mean it, because you can run a Linux 3.8 kernel on your Windows server, in Azure, on AWS, on your Mac. Strangely enough, you can even do it on physical computers. Not many people do that. But, you know, and so that was actually a really interesting kind of mind adjustment for me, is that, like, hey, actually, containers make a lot of sense when they're running in virtual machines. So we have, we're going to be providing two ways to run containers in Windows Server 2016. We're going to be providing Nano Server containers and Server Core containers. Today I'm going to be doing all my demos using the Server Core containers because that's what we made available in the technical preview 3. But the more interesting thing is, how do these actually come together? So the next thing we're doing is we're providing two ways to run containers. And that is, we have Windows Server containers and we have Hyper-V containers. Now, in full disclosure, we haven't released Hyper-V containers yet. We have promised that we're going to release a preview by the end of this year, and time's running out. So we'll have one soon. And I like to say to people, a lot of people are struggling to get their head around Windows Server containers. They're really struggling to get their head around Hyper-V containers. And I'm going to spend a bit of time trying to explain the difference between these two. But the high-level thing to understand at the end of the day is that our goal as an engineering team is that, one, whether you're using Windows Server containers or Hyper-V containers, the user experience should be identical. We want it to be very easy to build something in one of these runtimes and move it to the other runtime. It should literally just be a parameter when creating the container to say, do you want hypervisor isolation or not? But two, the reason why we're doing Hyper-V containers is, you know, containers do offer a lower level of isolation than virtual machines. And we wanted to be able to provide a great solution that gave all the benefits of containers, but also offered the production level isolation of a hypervisor. And that's what we're doing with Hyper-V containers. One of the questions I get all the time is like, well, when would I use Windows Server containers? When would I use Hyper-V containers? And this is definitely one of those ones where I go, we don't know yet. We are very interested to find out. You know, we do know that, like, obviously, if you're running your workload on AWS or on another virtualization platform, then it'll probably be Windows Server containers. We have theories that, hey, people are going to prefer to use Hyper-V containers for production deployments. We're waiting to see. This is something that we're very interested to understand. So what does this actually look like under the covers? Well, what this looks like is, if you think of a standard installation of Windows, you know, we can break it down to kind of not a low level, but a medium level. And you can say, OK, we have kernel mode, which has the drivers. It also has things like the memory manager, scheduler, so on, a whole bunch of the system level stuff. And then we have user mode, and you can kind of break user mode into two roles. There is the system processes, which are the things that are just part of Windows. You know, and these are the high level processes like, you know, DHCP and, you know, the different networking protocols and so on. And then you actually have the applications that you've installed running up in user mode. Well, with Windows Server containers, essentially what we've done is we've gone through and we've done a whole lot of work on the Windows kernel and on the interaction, on the boundary between the Windows kernel and the Windows user mode, so that the Windows kernel can now host multiple instances of user mode. And this has been, it's been a lot of fun to do. There's been a lot of interesting challenges. You know, there's been stuff where it's like, you know, part of the Windows DHCP stack lives in kernel mode. So we've had to go through and we've had to enlighten it and be like, hey, you can now have, you know, hundreds of instances of user mode talking to you. But this is what happens. You have a single Windows kernel and you have multiple user modes. And as you start extra containers, you get extra user mode instances. And I will show you when I'm doing demo. There's actually a little way you can peek into this and see this in the system, which is kind of cool. So that's what Windows Server containers look like. Single kernel, multiple user modes. So Hyper-V containers are then something else. With Hyper-V containers, what we're doing is we're essentially creating a virtual machine that has been highly optimized for the sole purpose of running containers. So give an idea of what we mean when we say highly optimized. If you take a generation 2 virtual machine and you look at the number of devices connected to it, it has about 22 devices. The virtual machine that we use for running a Hyper-V container only has 8. It's headless. It has no user interaction. Its sole purpose is to boot and launch the Windows container in an isolated fashion. So once again, same user experience, but giving you the hypervisor protection around that container. So just click through because I couldn't remember the animation there. So that's the runtime. But almost more important than the runtime is the way the images work. So containers have a completely different file system format to virtual machines. So with virtual machines, you have a block-based format. You install your operating system, and we have a whole bunch of technology based on it, but it's all block-based. The container image stack is file-based, and it's very important that it is file-based. The next thing that's really important is that for Windows containers, we are providing a common container OS image that is signed by Microsoft. So you get a Windows Server Core image or a Windows Nano image that's signed by Microsoft, and then everything you do, you build on top of that image. And that's really important. I'll get to that as we're going through this workflow. So you start with a blank machine. You've got the Windows Container OS image. And you say, I want to create a new container. Well, every time you create a container, you're actually creating a differencing layer at the file system level. This is a whole new set of technology that we've built in Windows Server 2016. So one of the most common questions I get when we talk about this is I have people asking, like, oh, are you using this technology? Oh, are you using that technology? And the answer for the imaging stuff is, no, we took a bunch of engineers and we built something entirely new for this. But every time you start a container, you're creating a differencing layer off of something. And as this container runs, any changes that you make to this container are automatically written to this sandbox layer. Another common question I get, by the way, is I get people asking, like, hey, can I create my own, you know, base OS image? And the answer is no. And we don't want you to do that, but you don't need to do that, because as well as allowing you to make additions, we actually allow you to make subtractions and make modifications, and we track that as part of the container image layer. So anything that you want to do, you can do in this layered file system. So I go ahead, you go ahead, you make your changes, and when you're at a stage where you're like, hey, this is a good set of changes, you can actually now capture that as a new container layer. Once you've captured it as a new layer, this enables a couple of things. The first thing is it allows you to export it and give it to someone else. Now, this is really important. This is where the value of us having a signed container base OS image comes in, because in this example, I've installed Node.js. I can give a very small set of changes to someone else, and I can know that they're going to have the same signed base image. So I don't have to be shipping around entire operating system installations. I'm just sending around my changes very efficiently. The other thing I can do is once I've captured this, I can then start creating new container images on top of that. So now I can say, OK, give me another system, and it's going to already have the Node.js bits in it that I installed. I can install my application. I can do my customization. So with all that said, let's actually play with the system and see what this looks like. I like to say this is the most exciting demo in the world. Have you ever seen that many command prompts on a screen? You know you're in for a good demo when there are this many command prompts. Fortunately, I do know that it's no fun to watch someone type slowly, so I have my whole demo script here, and I'm just going to be cutting and pasting. So this virtual machine in the middle is running Windows Server Core Technical Preview 3, and I've enabled the container role on it. If I get image, you can see that I have the Windows Server Core image. That's the signed image provided by Microsoft. And just to highlight, I've got a single switch in here that's set up in NAT mode. I will say before I move on, good story about that. So one of the things we do support with containers, you can actually use a virtual switch in standard mode, and it'll operate just like a Hyper-V virtual switch. But we've added the ability to run it in NAT mode as well. And we did that kind of for two reasons. The first one is we expect to see people running a lot of these in public clouds like Azure and AWS, and they have limited IP addresses. You get a virtual machine, it comes with a single IP address. The second reason is one of the properties of containers is they're really quick and easy to create and throw away, even easier than virtual machines. And while we were working on this, before we got the NAT networking working, we actually had a couple of weeks where every day my development team was exhausting the building of IP addresses. It was fantastic. It took us a while to figure this out. We had a couple of days where every day it would get to about 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and all of a sudden you would have all these developer emails going like, who broke networking? Like, I'm starting a container and I'm not getting an IP address. What's going on? And we'd have all these investigations, and that no one could figure it out. And the next day, 9 a.m., it's like, oh, it's working again. And it took us a couple of days before we realized, oh, we're running out of DHCP leases in our building. So I've got the NAT switch. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a new container. And so this command, I'm just saying, create a new container, call it my container, use the Windows Server Core image, and connect it to the virtual switch. So, okay, so I've just created that container. If I get container, you can see I have a single container there. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start the container, and I'm going to enter it. So this is starting the container, and then it's using PowerShell to connect to a PowerShell session inside the container. And that quickly, I just created a new instance of Windows. So it took about 2-3 seconds. And that is from nothing to deployed, running, ready to go. So incredibly fast. It's also using a very small amount of memory. So now that I have this, I can then do some stuff in it. So what I've got here, I'm going to download a web server. I'm going to expand it. And let me just show you before I exit. If I dir, we've got Nginx installed there. So I'm going to exit. I'm going to stop that container. So I've just created a container, started it, gone in, downloaded some bits, set them up, exited. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, let's create a new container image using that container. So here I'm going to say, new container image using my container, publisher, demo, name, Nginx, Windows, version 1.0. So that's just created a new container image layer. So I now have two container images. I have the Windows Server Core image, and I have the Nginx layer. So now I can say, OK, I want to create a second container. This container I'm going to call Web Server 1. And instead of using my Server Core image, I'm going to use the Nginx image that I just made. So let's go ahead and do that. If I get container now, you can see, OK, I've got two containers defined. I've got the first one I created, and I've got my web server. I'm going to run a bunch of commands in a row. And what this is going to do is it's going to start my web server container. It's going to enter it. It's going to go and start the Nginx service. And it's going to run. And there it is, running process. Sorry? It was still there. It's the container image. I didn't do get container image, and you would have seen the Microsoft one there too. So there I have a web server running. Now, let me just exit this. To highlight, what I've just showed you is a workflow that most of us are familiar with. Like, if you do cloud design patterns using virtual machines, you know, you're used to the idea of, I'm going to create a base image, I'm going to customize it, and then I'm going to spin up virtual machines using differencing disks or whatever. That's the way you do it efficiently at scale. However, like, if we're honest with ourselves, what that process actually looks like with virtual machines is, I'm going to create a virtual machine, I'm going to install Windows, I'm going to install all the patches, I'm going to get it up to date, I'm going to do all my customization, then I'm going to run sysprep, I'm going to shut it down, then I'm going to create a differencing layer, I'm going to start it up, I'm going to install my applications, I'm going to customize all that, I'm going to run sysprep again, I'm going to shut it down, and then I have a process which will allow me to start new workloads in a mere 5 minutes. And the other thing is, if we're all honest, what I just talked through is days of work. You know, and I've just showed you that same workflow in 2-3 minutes on stage. And this is kind of what we talk about when we say we're designing this to work for cloud workflows. You know, a great example is if you think about, you know, using differencing layers with virtual machines, you know, one of the things, know, is that you always have to use sysprep. You're using sysprep all the time. Because in a world of physical computers have a completely reasonable expectation that the next time they start, they're still going to be the same computer. You know, so when we brought that across to virtual machines expect that the next time they start, they're still going to be the same computer. And it's an unusual idea to a classical install of Windows to be like, no, you're starting, but you're now a different installation. Whereas in the cloud, that's your default mode. You know, your default mode is, I want to start up and I want to be a new instance. I want to have a new identity. And so that's the default mode with containers. You'll notice I didn't have to run sysprep at any stage because every time we say new container, you know, from this image, we automatically give that image a new system identity. And we just take all the intermediate work that's involved in that out of the loop. So let's throw this away. Done with that demo. Let's jump back to presentation. So now I want to talk about some of the workflows that we think about. Now, a lot of people come and ask me, hey, where should we be using containers? What scenarios are you thinking about? And I always have to start with the, like, we don't know what we're doing. Like, so these are really good questions. One of the things that we do know, and a side note, actually, and just to highlight this, I often get asked, you know, hey, you know, if you gaze into the crystal ball, like where do you see containers versus virtual machines playing out in the future? And let me tell you, even on the core virtualization engineering team, this is a great debate that we have. This is a good Friday afternoon debate for the engineering team. Oh, because we have people on the team who are like, you know what, these containers are great and so on, but they're gonna serve a couple of needs, and virtual machines are gonna reign, and they're gonna rule the day. Then we have people on the team who are like, no man, like containers are gonna take virtual machines down. And like in 10 years' time, it's gonna be all containers, and you're not gonna see any virtual machines. And then we have some people on the team, God bless them, who go like, nah, in 10 years' time, we'll have invented something entirely new, and both containers and virtual machines will be gone. Fine. I just say like, okay, let's keep on working on this and let's see how it comes together. One of the scenarios we are talking a lot about is containers for application development. And we're talking about this for two reasons. The first reason is we actually believe there's a lot of value here. The second reason is that in order for, you know, one of the big things I've been talking about is we built virtual machines for physical computers, we built containers for the cloud. What that means is that in order to get the most out of containers, you kind of need applications that are written to be designed for cloud and container workflows. You know, so one of the big conversations we're having is like, if you have developers at your company, you should be looking at how can we use containers and how can we start building architectures that take this into consideration. We do want to allow people to bring across their existing applications, but our focus is on getting the next wave of applications built around containers. So what do we think this is great for developers? First thing, actually, show of hands, how many people here are developers? Would say I'm a developer? Woo, fantastic. How many people would say, like, I'm the sysadmin, the guy who runs Fabric? Okay, so I'm gonna poke some fun at developers here. It's okay, it's fine. I spend a lot of time talking to both sysadmins and developers. And one of the things, and I talk to, because a large part of my job is working with the development teams and helping them to understand people. And one of the things I love to point out is a great difference between system administrators and developers is, dear sweet Lord, developers have no threshold for pain. None whatsoever. Like, I can take a system administrator and I can say, look, this is going to be really hard to set up and it's going to take days of your life and here's the 100-page white paper. But like, when you're done, like, man, it's going to be awesome. Like, a sysadmin is like, yeah! And goes off and does it. Fantastic. You get a developer, and you're like, it's going to take half an hour, and they're, screw that. Like, as you know, I haven't got half an hour. Like, I like to say, a developer, you got like 5 minutes to get them to the happy moment, or they're off looking at something else. You know, so the first thing is, like, containers get developers to the happy moment in under 5 minutes. Woo! Like, compared to virtual machines, developers can spin up a container and say, I want to be running, and they can be running in a couple of seconds. And that's the sort of environment that developers want. So we definitely see a lot of developers saying, like, hey, containers are great because I don't have to deal with waiting for these virtual machines to provision. They take forever. So it's great. But then what happens is, it's not only is it easy for developers to spin up, it's easy for them to then redistribute. So the workflow we see is, you know, developers get to use the same tools, the same experience that they have today, but they're building inside a container. And once they've made their changes, it's then very easy for them to capture just those changes and provide them to other developers or provide them to the sysadmin. And in fact, one of the workflows that we're most interested in, I mean, I want the next slide. Yeah, this one. One of the workflows that we're seeing and that we're most interested in is a workflow where you have these very small, lightweight containers. They're used by the developer on his computer while he's developing, given to the sysadmin, and she's able to deploy it in exactly the same environment and in exactly the same way. One, this drastically reduces the potential for it works on the developer's computer and not on the production server. Two, when issues are encountered in production, it makes it really easy to give it back to the developer and say, here's exactly the environment that the issue was hidden. So with that, let me skip over to my next demo. And this is actually one that we put together that we spent a lot of time trying to come up with a demo this complicated, said sarcastically. So let's see. Oh, I gotta hit the right button. Go across to my demo system. It is not switching. It's blinking, but it's not switching. I have the man in black coming down. Apparently, we've locked up the console. It's all good. There's lots of blinking lights up here. It always makes me happy. Side note, I don't know if you've ever noticed this. The audio guys are always the people in black, so you can always spot them when you're having problems on the stage. Absolutely. Yep. The question was, is it possible to audit file differencing? Not in the current build. That's a good question. Our focus right now is on getting the performance and the compatibility to be as best as it possibly can be. So our top focus right now is just having a great experience around developing and standing up containers. This is fantastic, by the way. You should be up here. All the screens are going crazy and flashing. Giving me lots of confidence. See if we get lucky. Sorry, what was the question? Oh, it would work if it was in a container. Yeah. Thankfully, we're not running containers on the switching machine itself. So it's not my code. That is, I will say that is one of the things. I'm one of the few people in the world who, whenever I see that there's been an outage or a problem in Azure, my first thought is like, don't be my code. So I'm happy when something's going wrong and it's not my code. OK, apparently. But it's not up there. Yes! Woo! Okay. Yay. Applause for the AV guys. So here I have, using this console over here, I have the most complicated program in the world. You can see here. And what we've actually done is we've put together, this is a little .NET 5 application, which if I run it, you can see it says, hello world, and hello world, from my improved console writer, because my team of developers thought they could come up with a better way to write hello world. And as you can see, that's run. That's fantastic. But now I can say, I forgot to set that up. Now I can say, let's test that in a container. So I'm going to publish my application, and then I've got a Docker file here where I'm going to first build a Docker container that contains my application. And once that's built, and what this is it's packaging just my application in a container in Docker. And once that's built, I'm going to say, OK, let's run that inside a Docker container. And what we'll see in just a moment is it's going to fail miserably. Well, why did that happen? Well, that happened because, and we had to craft the code just right for this, the improved console writer that we put together actually takes a dependency on a DLL that is installed as part of Visual Studio. This is the classic, it runs on my computer problem. You know, a developer could very easily take this dependency, not realize it's there, because every box that they try it on has Visual Studio, it has this DLL in it, and it works. But now I can go like, ah, that didn't work. So let me throw away that image and check my change. I've just commented out the offending line. And now I can go ahead and I can say, okay, let's publish that and try it again inside a container and see if it's actually going to work in a production environment. So the great thing about this is it's a very easy tool for me to use. You know, this is much more lightweight than running a full virtual machine, but it gives me the validation and it gives me the environment. And what we're seeing is that people are using this as a development tool, but then once they get used to using it as a development tool, they're saying, hey, rather than giving my ops guy, you know, all the bits and saying, go install it, I can just give them the container that comes out of my build system and say, we know this works, go and deploy it and use it. Let's see if I can switch back. Yes. So the final thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about some of the ecosystem around containers. So what do we see people doing with containers? We see people doing a whole lot of things. And I do want to be really clear, you know, as I've been saying all along, this is a V1, we're learning as we go along. So I'm not saying that this is the definitive set of stuff that you do in a container. I'm just saying this is what we see people doing. You know, containers have a lot of interesting properties. You know, as you've seen, they're really fast to create, they're small to distribute, and so on. So we see people doing a lot of interesting workloads. We see a lot of distributed computing. We see a lot of scale-out. We see a lot of batch and task-based operations. You know, I like to say, you know, if I'm talking to someone and I hear the phrase scale-out proxy, fantastic workload for containers. But we also see people doing a lot of different things. But these are the ones that we've been seeing pop so far. We've also been doing a lot of work to provide a lot of different ways to manage and interact with containers. So I've showed you two different ways so far. I use the Docker commands. I use the PowerShell commandlets. We're also working with a whole bunch of our partners and tooling to make sure that we have experiences for all these different environments. So we've got some preview stuff out there for Visual Studio that allows you to interact with containers and publish directly to containers. We're also getting a whole lot of ecosystem out there because of the integration work that we've been doing with Docker. So I do actually want to spend a moment to talk about that, and I'm going to show you a demo of Docker integration and talk about that a bit deeper. But the first thing I'd love to just kind of touch on, I'd like to dispel some myths and give a bit of insight to you guys. The first myth to really dispel is a lot of people go like, oh, Docker, that's containers. And it absolutely isn't. Docker is actually a great management tool for working with containers. You know, and it's interesting because even the Docker guys do not view themselves as container people. They view themselves as a developer and application platform. Now, they happen to use containers underneath, but they're not the container technology themselves. So the interesting story here was we were working on Windows Server containers for a while, and we kind of got to the stage where we were like, you know what? We should really go and meet with the guys at Docker and let them know that we're working on Windows Server containers. And our expectation, and this was before we'd announced publicly that we were working on Windows containers in any way, shape, or form, our expectation was that we were going to go and meet with them and tell them this, and they were going to say, well, that's nice, go away, please. And we were going to go away and, you know, go on our merry paths. Instead, when we went and met with them and we said, hey, we're working on Windows containers, their immediate response was, that's fantastic. Can we work together? And we're like, sure. So we've been actively working with the team at Docker for just over a year now. And one of the things I have to highlight to people is often when I'm talking about Docker, they're thinking that we're doing some sort of Docker compatibility layer. And we're not. We are doing Docker. We are contributing to the Docker project. All the code for running Docker on Windows is up on the Docker GitHub account. When you run the Docker engine, you are running Docker. Now, what this means, one of the huge benefits that this gives you is any tooling that talks to Docker works for Windows containers. You know, so we have, there's a whole ecosystem out there, you know, Mesos, Kubernetes, a whole bunch of infrastructure coming together, a whole bunch of different management tools coming together, where they talk to the Docker API, and all of that just works with Windows containers, which is really awesome to see. So, if the switcher is working, let's jump over and I'll show you my last demo. Yes. They didn't tell me this, they changed the number. It used to be 8, it's now 7. So let's throw these away. And actually, I'm a little paranoid because I think I got that right. Okay. Okay. So what I have here is I have two virtual machines running behind the scenes. I have one virtual machine that's running Ubuntu, and I have one virtual machine that's running Windows Server Core Technical Preview 3. They both have Docker installed and configured on them. And if you look, you can see I have the demo Linux Docker and demo Windows Docker. Everyone always asks me what they are. They're just PowerShell functions that I put together that set the environment variable so that Docker goes to the right IP address in each console. So to show you what this looks like, so I'm running the Docker client on Windows, and both sides, I don't have any Docker things running right now. But if I have a look on the Linux side, it's got an Ubuntu image. If I have a look on the Windows side, it's got the Windows Server Core. It's also got the ASP.NET 5 image that I created earlier on. So what I can do is on the Linux side, I can say Docker run Ubuntu. And on the Windows side, I can say Docker run Windows Server Core. And what this does is same experience, same tooling. And you can see if I come here, I have config. This guy's got his own IP address, own system. If I do ipconfig here, own IP address, own system, similar experience, similar APIs. The one I do like to do is just to show something a little different is to say, you know, Docker run PowerShell. This is creating a Windows container with PowerShell in it, and I could do get process. Now, the great thing is in all of this is that it's the same experience, it's the same tooling, and this all works remotely as well as locally. You know, so a great conversation to have here is how many people use both Linux and Windows in their environment? Good number. How many of you have the same team managing both those environments? How many of you use the language, oh, he's the Windows guy, and he's the Linux guy? Yeah, that's terrible. You know, it just is, you know, because it's not efficient. And we have the number of companies that we talk to where you actually see, you know, the Windows guys and the Linux guys doing completely different things and duplicating work and being hugely inefficient. And it's one of the big focuses that we have at Microsoft at the moment is we want to make it easier for the Linux guys and the Windows guys to work together. You know, and that's one of the big reasons why we've been investing in the Docker interoperability is so that we can provide, you know, seamless tooling and experiences. Now, a little story on that. I actually got to attend LinuxCon this year, and I was at the Microsoft booth, and we had a bunch of the Microsoft Loves Linux stickers. And the one that killed me, because I'm just like, this is wrong on so many levels, is I actually had someone come by the booth and pick up one of the Microsoft Loves Linux stickers and look at me and go, this is great, I'm going to go get this, and I'm going to give it to my Windows guy. Like, this isn't why we're here doing that. Like, we're not here to make the war worse. We're here to try and get you guys to work together. No, but this is, you know, a big thing to highlight here is that, you know, for people who have development happening both on Windows and Linux, we're now starting to get this tooling together so that you can use the same workflows. You can use the same build processes. You can use the same publish processes. And that's one of the big reasons why we've been investing in this. So let me switch back across. That was just the demo I did. So what are the next steps? The big call to action here is we really want people to start playing with this and giving us feedback. So as I mentioned, we have the preview up, msdn.microsoft.com/virtualization. And you know, because as I mentioned, we know developers have a very low pain threshold, there's a single script that you run that will get you up and running. So you can go there, open a PowerShell window, run one command, and we'll set everything up for you and get you up and running so that you can start playing with Windows containers. So please start playing with it. Start giving us feedback. Now, at this stage, I've left a chunk of time because I know people have questions. So I would love to open up for questions about containers, Windows containers. Question is, can you get the Windows Loves Linux stickers? Honestly, I don't know. I don't have any here with me. One of the funniest ones, which it was just like, this was like, okay, the world is turned upside down, was we got halfway through LinuxCon, and we actually got in trouble and got told to take the Microsoft Loves Linux stickers away because we hadn't put the trademark on Linux. I love that. But I don't think we have any here, but let me check. We might have some. So the question was, is Docker coming to Windows 10 desktop? I'm going to be a little bit devious in my answer. So first, I'll give the approved answer that I'm allowed to give. So the approved answer is, I could have actually done all the demos that I've done today on Windows Client just using virtual machines and running the Docker client there. And in fact, that is the most common pattern we see, is people running a client OS, running the for development, and running the server in a virtual machine. And everything I showed you would have worked in that situation. And as I mentioned, the Docker, both the Docker client and Docker engine, we're just using the binaries from GitHub. The slightly devious answer is if you go and check Twitter for, I track Twitter for all the phrases that I work on. I tell people you can't mention Hyper-V without me seeing the tweet. And every now and then someone tests me on it, and yeah, I spot it. I also have, I watch for people talking about Windows containers. Someone tweeted on Windows containers yesterday and pointed out that we currently have a job offer up for the Windows kernel team where we're specifically looking for someone to work on container technology for client. I have no idea what that job offer is about. as I mentioned all along, it's a V1 technology. We have a lot of crazy ideas. Expect to see a lot more in this space in the coming couple of years. Any other questions? The question I always get asked. So the question was, how does that work from a licensing perspective? So I was in Sweden 3-4 weeks ago, and I got asked the same question, and I gave this answer, and it got put on Twitter. So I'll give the same answer, and that is, I build it, I don't sell it. So I don't know. Fortunately, I don't have to deal with that. More seriously, though, the real reason why I'm not giving an answer is we're actively in discussion with the licensing people, figuring out how we license the different container technology. You know, the inside story here is it's always an awkward question to ask someone at Microsoft, because for the people on the engineering team, our position is always that we just want everyone to use our stuff. So we're like, can you give it away for free in every SKU? That would be great. And then we have the business people being like, actually, we need to pay your paycheck at the end of the day. So that discussion is going on right now. So I can't give an answer yet. How would Windows patching work? This is actually a really good question. And unfortunately, I don't have the answer, but I'd love to discuss some of the stuff. Because this has been a great topic of debate on the team. You know, because there's, you know, if we look at what's happening in Docker and Linux containers right now, kind of the philosophy that people have taken around patching for Linux containers is like, well, the way you patch is you get a new base image and you rebuild your whole container tree. You know, and if you get in a room full of snooty academic people and you discuss this, that's like, yes, we think that's the way you should do container images. Now, we kind of have two problems with that statement. I mean, it's a great, you know, if you're drawing on a whiteboard, it's a great statement. The first problem is, if that were really the case, why do 80% of Docker files out on the Docker Hub right now start with their first line being apt-get update? Because they do. The second one is, right now, and this was actually just done by a third-party security audit, about 70% of the Docker images on the Docker Hub right now are susceptible to Heartbleed. Because people haven't been rebuilding them and they haven't been keeping it up to date. So this is actually something we're right in the middle of working on. With the previews that we're putting out, we're just saying, hey, these are technical previews and we're never updating these. They're great to play with, but when the next version comes out, throw them away and build a new one. But we're actively working on this. You know, ideally, like our number one focus is we want to make sure that we have, you know, by the time we RTM, we have a great way to keep these up to date in production. Whether that's rebuild, whether that's, you know, Windows update, whether that's some new mechanism, we're still working through that. So that's a big focus for us. So the question was, I saw that the server core image was about 9 gig. How big will the nano image be? I'm not supposed to say, but the answer is 200 meg. It's actually, I know, side note, actually, I said I would show you this, and I didn't. Let me jump across. So it's actually, I mentioned that these are really lightweight. One of the things that's really nice about them is right now, starting a server core image uses somewhere between 80 to 120 meg of memory. And starting a nano image uses even less. So they use a really small amount of memory. They also, each of the images, while the base image is quite large for server core, each of the images themselves are quite small. So I've actually, I've set up a Minecraft server inside an image, and when I exported it, it was about 200 meg. And we've actually made some work to make that even smaller. So let me just show you something while I'm here. So I've got my web server running. And if you remember, the web server currently has Nginx process running inside of it. So if I bring up Task Manager inside this, and this is kind of interesting because, you know, and I'll just scroll up here. You'll remember when I was in the container, I ran get process, and the container only sees the processes that it has access to. But because we're doing this virtualization at the kernel layer, the container host can actually see everyone's processes. So if I jump over here and I go to the details, we should be able to find the Nginx process that's running inside the container. So there it is. But let me see if I can remember how to do this. Get process. And I have to remember what the parameter is. We were discussing this just the other day. Somewhere on here is a parameter where I can actually tell which container it's running in. It's the session ID. So let's do process, and we'll grab name. So if I do get process, select session ID and name, what you can actually see is each container has its own session ID. So C-exec is running in a container, and that's number 3. So I could even do get process where session ID. And that from the host has shown me the processes that are running in that container. So just a handy little trick. So any other questions? So yeah, so the question is, would it make sense to just be updating the base image? We're fairly certain that no matter what we do, we're going to be releasing frequent updates to the base image so that people can build up-to-date containers. But the question is, you know, what do we do on top of that for allowing people to patch and service and keep containers up to date? So we're still trying to figure that out. Any other questions? If not, I'll wrap up. Thank you. We've got one more. I'll take one more question, then I'll wrap up. No, I've got two questions. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear because they turned the music on. So the question was, would patching the machine that the container is running on affect the container itself? That's actually, the short answer is no. And that's actually why we have the separate container OS image. One of the things we actually debated while we were building this was not having a container OS image and just having the containers use all the files and components from the container host OS. Now, one of the immediate challenges that we hit with that is if we did that, we couldn't provide the portability guarantee. Like, we wouldn't be, because you know, you're going to have container hosts which are running at different patch levels. And we wanted to be able to provide the portability guarantee. That's why we have the different image. Well, one last question, and then I'll... Sorry, can you... So the question was, what about passing configuration information into the Docker image? What do you mean when you say configuration information? So like application settings and details like that. This is actually still something that we're working through. Right now, it's a bit clunky to do that. One of the things that we do have on the list that we're working on is we want to be able to support shared folders and environment variable passing so that you can have different ways to, as you're creating a container, pass information in. So with all that, I'd like to say thank you for your time. Please play with containers and give us any feedback that you have.